Senate Judiciary will come to order. The Secretary will take the roll. Please.
Vice Chair McGilvery?
Here.
Vice Chair Sands?
Here.
Senator Esp?
Excused.
Senator Heinbaugh?
Excused.
Senator Bennett?
Here.
Senator Manzella?
Here.
Senator Weber?
Here.
Senator Brown?
Here.
Senator Friedel?
Excused.
Senator Gross?
Here.
Senator Regeer?
Excused. Quorum is present. Senate Judiciary is ready for business. We'll open. Members, just let you know we'll open on 318. Those in the audience, be sure you turn off your cell phones. Make sure you sign in for testimony. And we'll begin with Senate Bill.
Mr. Chair? Yes, Mr. Vice Chair, could you give us the order of all the bills then for EA, the order of them for today, please?
Yes. Well, the order of bills for hearing is 318, 271, 280, and then 277. And then executive action is Senate Bill 256, Senate Bill 259, and Senate Bill 283. Senator Sands.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
You're welcome. All right. Any other questions before we begin? Senator Manzella, you'll begin the hearing on Senate Bill 318.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of Judiciary. I am Teresa Manzella, representing Senate District 44, which is in the north end of the beautiful Bitterroot Valley. And today I bring a very simple, short, sweet bill for you, Senate Bill 318. And all it does is an act revising laws for the judiciary, restricting a judge in a city court from practicing law in the city court, and amending sections 3-1-604. We don't want judges practicing law when they're dual purpose, when they're a judge and they're an attorney. They shouldn't probably be practicing law within their own jurisdiction in their own court. So I was asked to carry this bill by Attorney General Knudsen, and he was asked to give an opinion on it, and it is his wisdom that he's bringing it before the legislature for us to make a decision. So with that, I will allow the proponents and opponents to speak.
Thank you, Senator Manzella. Proponents for Senate Bill 318.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Alan Doan, D-O-A-N-E, here today on behalf of Attorney General Knudsen. We were asked for an Attorney General opinion on this small little niche of law, and we thought, well, hey, the legislature's in town. Let's find a title and a sponsor, and here we are, allowing the legislature to legislate. So we'd appreciate a due pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents in the room? Seeing none, are there any opponents or any proponents online? Seeing none, any opponents in the room? I see none. Any opponents online? See none. Informational witnesses? Seeing none. Questions from the committee? Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. For Mr. Doan, please.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Doan, can you describe the nature of the request for the Attorney General's opinion?
Mr. Chairman, I couldn't hear that.
She asked, can you describe the nature of the Attorney General's request for the opinion, the request of the AG for the opinion?
Yeah, my understanding, there's a city judge from Hamilton that had asked for an Attorney General opinion on existing law, why there was a small niche that he couldn't practice law in a court outside of his own, Mr. Chair.
And follow up, Mr. Vice Chair. Thank you, Mr. Doan. Did this particular judge want to continue to practice law as he was sitting on the bench?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understood that whole question.
You want me just to repeat it for you?
Yes, please.
She asked, did the judge want to continue to practice law while that judge was on the bench?
Yes, but not in his own court, Mr. Chairman. I think the problem is these city judges, it doesn't pay enough to make a living, and it makes it impossible for an attorney to be a city judge if he can't practice outside of his own court also. I think that's the whole stem of the issue.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Seeing none. Oh, Senator Sands, sorry.
Mr. Chairman, again, I don't totally understand this bill still, I guess. First of all, who are the other judges besides a municipal court
Senator
judge?
Sands, Mr. Doan, I think she's asking you the question.
Yeah, my apologies.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I can't hear anything that comes over the TV.
I can repeat.
Can't hear anything? Okay.
Senator Sands, go ahead and ask your question and I'll repeat it.
Great. Well, I'll break it into some segments then. So the first is, who else practices in a city court besides a municipal court? And I understand there are temporary appointments, but is this about people who might be doing it temporarily, or is it only about judges in their term of office, which means they're elected?
Who else practices in a city court and a municipal court? I don't know if I could repeat the rest of the question.
I think we should just get back to maybe just looking at the bill, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I don't know how many people this is affecting out there or not. I know it is affecting one, or we wouldn't have got that request for the Attorney General opinion if the question was how many people out there are doing that. I don't know how many are temporary part-time people. Probably in small towns, there's quite a lot of them that are temporary and part-time city judges. I don't know if
Chairman,
that answered the question or not.
Well, not really, but here is, since the last words are saying that they can't do it during the judge's term of office, I would assume that this then applies only to a judge that has been elected, not someone who is just serving in a temporary capacity. Am I understanding this correctly?
The question is, does this apply to only a judge that has been elected and is serving in his current term of office?
I don't know the answer to that.
Senator Sands, could you defer to the sponsor?
Certainly.
So the bill reads, restrictions on municipal court judges and judges in city courts. A municipal court judge or a judge in a city court or a city court of record may not practice law before the judge's own court or hold office in a political party during the judge's term of office. That's the extent of the language. I think it's common sense that when a judge is also an attorney, he should not be practicing law within his own court. And as far as an appointment, it would, again, just going on common sense, if he was appointed, he's appointed for a term. So I would think that would apply to someone who's appointed as well.
Mr. Chairman, and Senator, the sponsor, I will ask someone else because I'm referring to people who are like, Ms. Burkhart said she might have some clarity here because there are a lot of judges in these local courts that are very temporarily appointed to do something. They don't have a term of office, they're just temporary. So can I defer to Ms. Burkhart, please?
Yes, Ms. Burkhart, could you enlighten us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sands, and members of the committee. I think it helps to kind of take a step backward. And so statute 31604 is already in the code. Only right now, it only refers to municipal court judges. So municipal court judges may not, under current law, hold office in a political party during their term of office. Term of office, it refers to the permanent judge who has been elected or even potentially been appointed to serve the rest of someone else's term for whatever reason. It doesn't, in my view, it does not apply to temporary judges. And so what this bill does is it expands that concept to cover city court judges also. And that's really all it does.
Thank you. That's clarifying. Thank you.
And Ms. Burkhart, I just have another question. Can you just explain the difference between a municipal court judge and a city court judge?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I'd actually have to look up those definitions because they evolve over time. But basically, a municipal court judge most small towns have city court judges. And then there's a different entity called a municipal court judge. They basically do the same thing, and they are the judge for that, you know, jurisdiction, such as Helena or Billings or, you know, wherever. They basically hold the same role. But I can go back and look up the specific definitions and provide more clarity for that, certainly.
Well, could you just email that to the committee when you find that out?
Certainly.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, would the sponsor like to close?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee, for a good hearing and good questions. And I think this is just a common sense kind of bill, and I ask for a due pass. Thank you.
Thank you. This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 318. We'll now open the hearing on Senate Bill 271. Senator Glenn, would you like to open on your bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Today, I bring you a simple bill. Senate Bill 271. I wanted to say I was going to continue the theme of simple bills, but not so sure. Anyway, hopefully this one's simpler. Senate Bill 271. So this is just simply that a judicial candidate may announce a campaign endorsement that the candidate has received. So, for example, let's say that I endorse a judicial candidate. They can then announce that or use that in their advertisements or their handouts or just with talking with people. And it's as simple as that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Do I have proponents for Senate Bill 271?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, Jeff Lasloffy, Lasloffy, with the Montana Family Foundation. We rise in support of the bill this morning. We thank Senator Glimm for bringing it forward. This bill deals with what is the biggest issue that we deal with in any election cycle. For those that may not know, we publish voter guides, and people constantly call us. Our phone literally rings off the hook with people saying, who am I supposed to vote for these judges? Do you know anything about the judges? And basically it boils down to the announce clause in the canons of judicial ethics that precludes judges from speaking to any issue that could potentially come before the court. So we're left with, I'm a nice person, I have a spouse, two kids, and a dog, please vote for me. And I don't mean to be facetious, but that's almost what it comes down to. We literally know nothing about these judges, and it's frustrating voters. So we began publishing a voter guide, and we asked judges questions retrospectively, not how they would vote on a certain issue, but we gave them a list of decisions and said, was this issue decided correctly, yes or no, to try to get at who they are. And they would just immediately point to the to the announce clause and say, sorry, we can't speak to that. So then we pointed them to the United States Supreme Court decision in the case of Minnesota v. White. And in that decision, the court said two major things. First of all, they said people that run for judgeships do not forego their First Amendment right to speak freely. And second of all, people that are asked to vote for judges have both the right and the responsibility to cast an informed vote. And for that reason, they deemed announce clauses to be unconstitutional. Guess what? That was like 2002, and we still have an announce clause in the Montana canons. And we have only had one judicial candidate ever that has filled out our questionnaire. And so people are still left with the fact that we know nothing about the judges. This issue that Senator Glynn is bringing forward barely scratches the surface. At least it would give you a metric, something to go by, anything to go by. We began in the last two election cycles to go back 30 years and look at the campaign finance giving reports of judicial candidates. And I'm not going to go into that in depth, but I will if you ask me during the questions. We think that this is a good bill, but it's just a start. If we're going to continue to elect our judges and not appoint our judges, we need to quit playing this game and give people enough information to cast an informed vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents in the room? Seeing none, do we have any proponents online? Seeing none. Opponents in the room.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Mudd, M-U-D-D. I am the executive director of the State Bar of Montana, and we rise in opposition today to Senate Bill 271. Keeping with the theme of is this a simple bill, I think we can just see from the last comments of the last proponent why it's actually not a simple bill. Montana has, as all of you are well aware, three branches of government. And the judicial branch of government is an independent branch of government. And it regulates the conduct of attorneys and the admission to the bar, as well as the conduct of judges through the Code of Judicial Conduct. And the preamble to the Code of Judicial Conduct in Montana says an independent, fair, and impartial judiciary is indispensable to the system of justice. The State Bar of Montana strongly supports the notion of a fair, impartial, and independent judiciary. As part of that, there is indeed in the Code of Judicial Conduct a prohibition on the use of endorsements. So judges are prohibited from using endorsements in their campaigns. It's Rule 4.1A7. That has been in there for some time. So this bill, which amends Title 13 of the Election Code, creates a fundamental tension because under Article 7, Section 2 of the Constitution, the courts, the judiciary, has the power to regulate the conduct of judges and those seeking judgeships through election. That's, again, the Code of Judicial Conduct. You would then have a provision of Title 13 passed by this body that conflicts with that. And the question is, who has the authority to regulate that conduct? And we would suggest that under Article 3, Section 1, that creates a separation of powers challenge under the Constitution, that the courts have the authority to regulate the conduct of judges. Now, Republican Party of Minnesota versus White was a landmark decision when it came out. However, more recently, federal courts in Montana had the opportunity to address the constitutionality of this very provision under the First Amendment. And in the case of French versus Jones, decided just 2 years ago, federal courts upheld Rule 4.1A7 and found that Montana had a compelling interest in an impartial and independent judiciary, and Rule 4.1A7 is narrowly tailored to those interests because it strikes an appropriate balance between a candidate's speech and Montana's interest in an impartial judiciary. That's controlling federal law in Montana. So we regret having to oppose this bill, but we think as it is drafted, it creates an unconstitutional infringement on the court's right to regulate the conduct of judges and judicial candidates, and a right that has been found to be constitutional under the First Amendment under controlling jurisprudence in Montana. So with that, Mr. Chairman, we would urge that the committee do not pass, and I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further opponents online? I see none. Informational witnesses? Seeing none. Questions from the committee? I do have a question. Is it Mr. Budd? Is that correct? Did I say that correctly? Mud?
Budd, M-U-D-D. Yes, okay, Mr. Chairman.
It's hard to hear in this room even with these mechanisms on your head. So I guess my question would be, I get that the judicial branch has the right, even a constitutional right, to regulate its own members. And that's what you're saying. And this statute would conflict with that. But what about the right of a voter? And what Mr. Laszlofy was talking about is really true. When it comes to judges, people are just at a loss. Mm-hmm. So what's your thoughts on how we should address this so that it's consistent with the Constitution and consistent with the voters' right to know who they're voting for and what those individuals stand for?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that's a very good question, actually, about how do we balance that. And in fact, in the Republican Party of Sanders County case, which is a companion case, really, to the French versus Jones case, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said that partisan political organizations could endorse political candidates. The question is really the use of that endorsement by the candidate themselves. And that gets to this notion of, can I comment on something, take a political position when I'm a non-political elected official and I sit on the bench? And so there's really two forms of tension there. One is, what can I use as a candidate for office or a sitting judge? What can I comment on? What can I announce on? And that gets to the notion of prejudging certain interests or commenting on certain political matters when I'm on the bench. Then there's this other question embodied, I think, in your question, which is, well, how do we learn something about what these judges stand for? And that's where independent organizations have the ability to comment on that. In fact, in the Republican Party of Sanders County case, the court said that partisan political organizations could endorse judges. But the judge just can't say anything about that. So I do think that tries to strike the appropriate balance, that if the Montana Family Foundation or somebody else wants to say, this is how we feel about these judicial candidates, that's different than the judge using that language themselves and announcing that I've been endorsed by such and such organization. And I think that tries to strike that balance. I admit that's a tough balance to try to strike, particularly when you're dealing with judges. And, you know, I can say as a former practicing attorney, I don't practice actively now, one of the things when you walk into the courtroom is you don't want to feel like the judge has some prejudged notion on your case. And if judges are commenting on political matters or commenting on matters that may come before them, that creates that appearance of impropriety, which is really what these codes are attempting to prevent. And so when someone comes in, and let's say I'm a active Republican in my community, and I've got a judge who says I've been endorsed by the Democratic Party, then I come in and I say, well, do I have a fair shot here? And that's really what we're trying to avoid with the Code of Judicial Conduct. So I hope that answered your question, maybe perhaps longer.
Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, would the sponsor like to close?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I think that the problem is evident. Voters don't have a clear way of seeing who judicial candidates are or learn much about them, and I think that this bill would help. I understand that there are separation of powers, but there also are checks and balances. And this is maybe not a huge check and balance, but it is an intent. It provides what the legislature's intent is, that these judicial candidates should be able to speak out and say just a little bit more about themselves and let the voters know. And it's a little bit, for them to want to hide behind it, it's disingenuous to say that they don't have opinions, because they do. We're all human. They didn't grow up in a bubble and suddenly get to be where they're going to be a judge and have no opinion on anything. So they have opinions, and to say that they don't is disingenuous. And I think as voters, it's our right to know a little bit more about them. With that, I close. Thank you.
Thank you. This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 271. We'll now open the hearing on Senate Bill 280. Sponsor would like to open on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, we've ended the simple bill section of the committee's time this morning. Senator Glimm from Senate District 2, GLIMM. Today, I bring you a bill revising the vital statistics law regarding the amendment of a birth certificate. What this bill boils down to is the role of the legislature and the role of state agencies. And when we have a major policy issue that is to be determined, it should come before this body. It should be deliberated by elected officials, and it should not be just merely instituted by rule. Directly after the 2017 session, the Department of Public Health and Human Services started to promulgate a rule that would allow someone to change their birth certificate that was contrary to what had been done before. And what this bill does is it's a reset. It brings us back to the way it was before DPHHS just changed it and made a rule. And so what it says is that the sex of a person on their birth certificate may be amended only if the department receives a certified copy of an order from a court with appropriate jurisdiction indicating that the sex of a person born in Montana has been changed by surgical procedure. DPHHS ruled that you could do that much more easily, and I think that there's two parts to this bill. One, we can debate the substance of the policy here of how you go about to change your birth certificate. And the other issue in this bill is that when we give rulemaking authority, we don't give rulemaking authority to set significant policy. And this was it was brought up many times during the interim while they were trying to do the rule, and the department ignored the legislature, ignored the president of the Senate and speaker of the House, and they went ahead and had their way with it. So I urge you to pass this, and we'll hear about proponents and opponents. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. Are there proponents for Senate Bill 270?
Chairman, members, for the record, Jeff Lasloffy, Lasloffy, with the Montana Family Foundation. This morning, we rise in support of Senate Bill 280. We want to thank Senator Glimm for bringing it forward. The bill before you reverses what is yet another administrative rule that was implemented without legislative oversight and that created a policy that was contrary to the direction of that the legislature has taken over the past 20 years. As you heard in 2017, after the legislature left town, DPHHS promulgated a rule that amended the process for changing the data on a birth certificate. The biggest policy change from a legislative perspective was changing the word sex on a birth certificate to the word gender. The birth certificate's is a record of vital statistics, and sex actually means something. It's binary, either male or female, and it's encoded in our DNA. Contrary, gender means nothing. It's a social construct based on a continuum of infinite possibilities. The second major change was allowing the document to be amended by declaration on an affidavit without the applicant having to actually make any physical changes whatsoever. Prior to the change, the department had to have received a certified copy of an order from a court indicating that the sex of the individual had been changed by a surgical procedure. Senate Bill 280 simply restores the original language. It still allows transgendered individuals to amend their birth certificate, and it allows individuals with intersex conditions to change their birth certificates without a problem. The larger challenge I think at issue here is the problem of agencies using the rulemaking process to do an end run around the legislature. In the case of this particular rule, several attempts were made to get the agency to hold off until the legislature could address the issue. All failed. The Senate President and the Speaker of the House both sent a letter to the agency saying that this was a major policy change that should be done in a legislative setting. They were ignored. The Health and Human Services Interim Committee tried to step in, but the motion died on a tie vote, which is the problem with the rulemaking process. It turns the entire legislative process on its head. When a bill moves through this process, it takes a positive vote to keep that bill moving along. Bills die on tie votes. The rulemaking process is exactly the opposite. Once a rule is promulgated, it is on a glide path to passing, and it's up to individuals or entities along the way to be able to come up with a positive vote to be able to stop it. Our interim committees are tied, and if you have a controversial bill like this, there's a good chance that the vote to stop it will die on a tie vote, as it did in this case, and the rule becomes, in effect, law. The Department of Justice could do nothing. The Secretary of State looked for ways to delay publication of the rule, to force the agency to complete the steps in the process that they are ignoring. But in the end, all of the lawyers agreed that the legislature had ceded too much power to the agencies, and their hands were tied. Rulemaking in the interim has become a way to implement policies that will either not survive the legislative process or have been specifically rejected by the legislature. One of the most egregious was the recent Department of Revenue rule that was overturned by the United States Supreme Court in the Espinosa case. As the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said in the Canyon Ferry case, small incursions must be resisted lest they grow greater. This was an incursion into the legislative process by a state agency. If the agency truly believes the policy and process surrounding birth certificates needs to be amended, then they can ask a legislator to bring a bill just like everyone else. Until then, we ask that you pass Senate Bill 280 and restore the birth certificate to the process to the way that it was before the agency charted a new course. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents in the room? See none. No opponents to the bill in the room.
Chair, members of the committee, Laurel Hess, H-E-S-S-E, here with the ACLU of Montana to voice our opposition to Senate Bill 280. By requiring transgender people born in Montana to undergo surgical procedures and navigate a court legal proceeding as a precondition to updating the sex designation on a birth certificate without regard to whether they want, need, or even have access to such surgery, Senate Bill 280 violates state and federal constitutional guarantees of equal protection and privacy. Senate Bill 280 violates equal protection because it discriminates against transgender people born in Montana on the basis of their transgender status and on the basis of sex. An Alabama district court recently struck down a similar surgery restriction on updating sex markers on Alabama driver's licenses because it violated equal protection clause doctrine. By requiring transgender people to undergo surgery as a precondition to accessing an accurate birth certificate, SB 280 also classifies on the basis of sex. And sex-based classifications imposed by a state are subject to an intermediate form of heightened scrutiny under Equal Protection Clause doctrine. In the past, states have argued that these types of laws are necessary to maintain accuracy of birth records, but in the court, those justifications have not survived heightened scrutiny, and the laws have been struck down. A U.S. District Court judge in Ohio said of a similar law, "The court finds that the defendant's proffered justifications are nothing more than a thinly veiled post hoc rationale to deflect from the discriminatory impact of their policy. SB 280 also runs afoul of Montana's privacy and dignity provisions. Personnel records and medical records are protected by our constitutional right to privacy. In State v. Nelson, the court said, quote, informational privacy is a core value furthered by state constitutional guarantees of privacy, and that the zone of privacy created by those provisions extends to the details of a patient's medical and psychiatric records. By requiring an individual to undergo surgery and then secure a court order in order to change the sex marker on a birth certificate, this bill violates the right to privacy and dignity. That is, an entire category of individuals who have either not undergone surgery or not obtained a court order will be forced to live with a birth certificate that contains an inaccurate sex marker. The state has no business, much less a compelling state interest, in creating these requirements for amendment to a birth certificate. And for those reasons, we urge a no vote. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, S.K. Rossi, R-O-S-S-I, here on behalf of the cities of Missoula and Bozeman in opposition to Senate Bill 280. As you've heard in testimony on prior bills, and you'll probably be hearing again on future bills, the cities of Missoula and Bozeman are opposed to any legislation that seeks to discriminate against transgender Montanans and non-binary Montanans. We passed non-discrimination ordinances in both of our cities for just those reasons, and any bill that would make transgender Montanans and non-binary Montanans feel less welcome in the state of Montana is objectionable to the cities of Missoula and Bozeman. I also want to point out that DPHHS has a standard rulemaking process that was followed during the change that we're talking about today. There's over a month available for public comment. That public comment was utilized by the public, and I just want to point out that the comments that were given to DPHHS during this rulemaking process were overwhelmingly in support of the rule change that's being discussed today. Just like this bill before you will have overwhelming opposition. The state of Montana has processes for public comment. They have processes for rule changes and lawmaking. Those processes were followed during this rule change. Montanans said they wanted that rule change, and that process is being followed during this bill, and Montanans are telling you they do not want this bill. So please vote it down. Thank you.
Other opponents, step up to the mic.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rachel Schmidt. I'm here, that's spelled S-C-H-M-I-D-T. I'm here representing the interests of the Associated Students of Montana State and University, and I rise today in opposition to Senate Bill 280, simply because the law as it exists provides flexibility to folks who seek to change the sex indicated on their birth certificate. The change is simply unnecessary. It isolates transgender folks who go through gender confirmation surgery, and it also isolates transgender, intersex, and non-binary folks who don't go through surgery but would like to change their birth certificate. I think it's really important that we give people the flexibility and discretion to manage one of their most private documents, and because of these reasons, I do urge a do not pass today. Thank you.
Thank you. Further opponents in the room?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Zuri Moreno, M-O-R-E-N-O. And I know that many of you are familiar with me as a lobbyist in the building, but today I am here representing myself and loved ones. I am, in fact, here to share a part of my mother's story. You see, my mother is an Indigenous trans woman who lives in poverty in a rural and conservative community where there is basically one of everything, right? Like one grocery store, one clinic, oddly enough, two tire shops. She is a quiet woman who keeps to herself, although watch out, she has a sharp tongue. And I live in constant fear for her safety. It was only a few months ago that the gender marker on her ID was updated. Before it was changed, her neighbor saw her old ID, found out she was trans, and shared this information widely within their small community. He also, this neighbor, makes a habit now of aggressively approaching her outside her home, and saying hateful things to her because she is trans. She also faced barriers in accessing healthcare due to her gender marker not matching her outward appearance. Basic healthcare, like getting a flu shot or renewing her diabetes medication prescription. It was only after surpassing many legal and monetary barriers that she was finally able to get her gender marker changed on her birth certificate and subsequently update her ID. The safety this creates for her is almost too vast for me to communicate to you, and it is a tremendous relief to my heart. Transgender folks, like my mother, already face sometimes insurmountable barriers and safety issues to get their gender markers changed. My mother could not have afforded it on her own if I was not able to pay for it. And she is a stubborn woman, so it took a little while to convince her to accept my help. Adding even more barriers to this life-saving change on an ID is harmful, and I urge a no vote on SB 280. Thank you.
Further opponents in the room?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Rager. That's R-E-A-G-O-R. I'm here on behalf of the Montana Human Rights Network and as a member of the transgender community. I strongly oppose this bill. I've facilitated support groups for transgender, non-binary, and two-spirit folks for almost 7 years across the state of Montana. And I have heard many, many stories about people having serious issues in employment, education, state licensure, and even their safety for people who have been unable to update their birth certificate. This has been a good change for our community. It has saved lives. It has kept people employed. It has allowed people to access housing. On a personal note, I worked in private security as an armed guard. On the job, my coworkers were unaware that I was transgender. I made this decision because I feared for my job and safety if my coworkers were aware of that private medical information. It was irrelevant to my job qualifications or my experience. My concerns and decision was confirmed when I was locked in an armored truck with a coworker who was carrying a firearm, which was required on the job. And he gave explicit details about using trans people for target practice. He didn't know he was sitting next to a transgender person. This is not a solitary experience. As members of the transgender community, my life is on the line. The sexual assault and homicide rate against transgender people, and especially against transgender women of color, is the highest in the country. Oftentimes, our ability to obtain a job, housing, or public services, and to even stay alive, is contingent on our ability to maintain private, medically relevant information. Having a birth certificate that doesn't match your gender identity or how the world sees you is extremely dangerous. The only reason I was able to maintain this information on the job was because I was able to update my birth certificate. This job required me to go through the state to obtain a security guard license. And the only reason I was able to obtain that security guard license without my employer and all of my coworkers finding out that I was transgender was because I was able to update my birth certificate. I had not had surgery, but I was a man, and I am still a man. Everyone deserves to be seen for who they are and treated as such. I urge you to vote down this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Further opponents?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Allison Reinhart, R-E-I-N-H-A-R-D-T, and I'm here on behalf of MASS, the Montana Associated Students. Many of the opponents have said why Senate Bill 280 should not pass, and I would also urge this committee to not pass this bill today. This bill puts transgender people at risk and unnecessarily discriminates against them by employers or state workers who access a copy of their birth certificate. Members of this committee, please vote no on Senate Bill 280. Let's not endanger the lives of transgender people. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any other opponents in the room? Ms. Todd, let's try to not repeat the previous testimony. So we have a lot of opponents online, too, and just ask you to do that. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jack Rink. That's R-I-N-C-K. I'm here representing the interests of the Associated Students of the University of Montana. And obliging you, Mr. Chair, we just stand in firm opposition to this bill. It's simply unnecessary. It's unneeded. And I really hope this committee tables it.
Thank you. Further opponents in the room? Seeing none, we'll go online. And Kelson Young.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Kelson Young with the Montana Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And I guess, to be honest, Mr. Vice Chairman, all I really have left to say after listening to that incredibly brave opponent testimony is I did not hear the sponsor or the proponent really get into any detail about why this bill is necessary, other than they were unhappy with how the administrative rule process went, which, by the way, was a thoroughly public process. To be honest with you, it just seems like there's such a disconnect in the Montana legislature between the real lives of trans people. And as you can see from my friends and colleagues today, they are the most human, brave people I know. And I just wish we would take our time to do things better than attack their basic dignity and their right to operate in our society free from harm. As you heard, Mr. Chairman, trans women and men are at the highest risk of violence in our society, especially in regards to domestic and sexual violence. And it is just beyond my understanding why we have to continue to spend time defending their basic human dignity. Please, Mr. Chairman, and please, sponsor, find something better to do. Thank you.
And Trunsdell.
Hello, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Anne Trusdell. That's T-R-U-E-S-D-E-L-L. And I'm here as the executive director of the National Association of Social Workers Montana chapter. And we are here to oppose SB 280. You've heard several stories about the impact of this bill and the importance of having accurate birth certificates and documentation. And as you requested, Mr. Chair, I will not repeat what others have said, and they have covered this issue much better than I would have anyways. But I will mention that I remember being a part of the process when DPHHS went through this rule change, and I was very grateful that they did follow the process. And myself and many others, including opponents, were allowed to have their voices heard when they made this rule change. And we sat there and we engaged in the democratic process there together. And finally, I would like to point out that passing this bill upholds maybe a few people's beliefs that they felt like DPHS didn't do this right, or maybe they just don't think trans people should exist in this state. But if you do pass this bill, you put real people, real lives in danger and at risk. That's the difference, people's opinions and people's lives being in danger and at risk. And I hope that you will take that weight into your decision today. Thank you for your time, and please vote no against SB 280.
Thank you. Danielle Vasquez.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Danielle Vasquez. For the record, that is V-A-Z. Q-U-E-Z, and today I am here on behalf of myself, just urging you all to vote no on this bill. You know, it's just unnecessary and very harmful, and have a lot more adjectives to use to describe this bill, but for the sake of time, I'll just leave it at that. Yeah, and, you know, like Kelson said before, you know, find something better to do instead of causing harm to more people. Again, asking you to vote no. Thank you.
Next, we have Kendra Nevin.
Hello, Chair, Committee. My name is Kendra Nevin. That's K-Y-N-D-R-A-N-E-V-I-N. I was the project coordinator for the Rural Transgender Wellness Project. This was a peer-reviewed study to assess the determinants of well-being, success, and suicidality in rural transgender populations, specifically Montana. This study is published in the Journal of Rural Mental Health, for your information. I was privileged to interview transgender people from all over the state for this study, and what emerged as one of the most consistent determinants of well-being and success for those in the study was the ability to transition and live as the gender they know themselves to be. As any empathetic person understands, the ability to participate in society and the sense of belonging that comes with that is very important to personal feelings of worth and security. You've already heard testimony about that security, but also I want the committee to know that transgender people on average are more well-educated than the general population, but at the same time, a lot less employed. And this bill would throw up even more roadblocks as far as public participation and getting jobs and just their general security every day. So I urge you to vote no on this, and thank you.
Thank you. Finally, we have Aiko Beck.
Mr. Chair, they're not online.
Not online. Okay. Do we have any informational witnesses? See none. Questions from the committee? Senator Sands.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. A question for Ms. Rossi, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sands.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, Ms. Rossi. You know, some things in this session seem like deja vu all over again, and this is certainly one of them. Basically, the purpose of this bill to make it more difficult for trans people to be able to simply change a record that complies with who they really are has been up before. We had it in 2017, I think it was a special session, SB 10 or whatever. Doesn't this bill, and it was defeated, so haven't we looked at this bill before this is an issue that simply doesn't need to happen. It did not have the support of the legislature, and it does not have the support of the public. Can you reflect on that? I think you were here during that session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sands, it was really difficult to hear you, but I think I understand the gist of your question. So in November 2017, during a special session, this rulemaking process was under consideration. And at that time during the special session, proponents of the bill before you now ran a bill during the special session, even though the special session wasn't supposed to be about LGBTQ rights at all, and asked that that rulemaking process be stopped. SB 10 failed during the special session, so that's one Democratic lawmaking process that failed. And then the rulemaking process went ahead with DPHHS. As I said, there's a 30-day public comment period. There's public comment allowed during those rulemaking hearings. All of that was done within the administrative rulemaking process. The proponents of this bill again tried to stop this rule there and failed. And now they are bringing this bill back to you in 2021 in the hopes of undoing the previous two losses on the exact same issue in 2017 and during the rulemaking process. So I think that this proposal has been vetted. This is now the third time it will be vetted. It will be hopefully the third time that it will eventually fail. But this body and the administration have both made it clear that gender markers on birth certificates should not be harder to change than they already are. So yes, this has been a democratically led process. It has happened in the legislature. It has happened at the administrative level. And we ask that it just be left alone. I mean, it's already been discussed and defeated twice, and we all need to move on. And for the record, Senator Sands, I use they, them pronouns. I would prefer not to be addressed as Ms. Thank you.
Thank you. I apologize.
For the question. Follow-up
question, Mr. Vice Chair.
Sure.
With the person from the Human Rights Network, I guess I will take.
Mr. Oh, Chair, Senator.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
If I'm breaking up. My question has to do with the surgery procedure. Could you enlighten us as to how often trans people or when in the process trans people have surgery, and doesn't this bill in some way sort of mandate that people have surgery when it's not the right time for them or not their decision in order to be who they are? Can you reflect on that part of this bill?
Yes, absolutely. So studies have shown that actually only 40% of trans people access surgery. And that is a very private decision that is determined by the individual. Oftentimes, that decision is one of the major factors that goes into that decision is whether or not they can financially afford to access surgery. But for a lot of people, when they're able to be seen for who they are, they don't feel the necessity to acquire surgery. It's a private decision, and it shouldn't be a factor if their other records can reflect accurately on who they are. So just to be clear, in order to change your Social Security card, in order to update your driver's license in the state of Montana, in order to obtain a passport, you do not have to have surgery. So the fact that the state of Montana is considering taking this rule back to the 70s when it was originally written is extremely detrimental. And in addition to that, it would put us out of line with federal and other state agencies. It just doesn't make sense. Thank you.
Thank you.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Senator.
Could you be just clear about that one more time, which is, so to have this bill that would then mandate surgery in order to be recognized as a trans person, that would be both, for many people, an unnecessary and an unwanted surgery. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Mandated by law to be who you are.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Chair. Senator Manzella?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Laszlofy, please.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Manzella.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Laszlofy, there's been discussion concerning the effort on this in the special session, and I wanted to ask your opinion on that and what your recollections are.
So thank you for that, Mr. Chairman. Senator Manzella, a couple points of clarification. So nobody in this room, as was alluded to, started that process. So the legislature already, this was up on their radar screen. They realized that the committee had failed to be able to stop it. They thought maybe they could use the special session to stop it. There were two senators that brought bills forward. We were involved because we were at the special session, and it would be an issue that we would get involved with if asked, and we were and we did. The reason that those bills didn't get further than they did in the session is because it was made clear early on that the point of the special session was not to deal with these types of bills. And so this was an issue that the senators brought on themselves, and leadership finally just said, you know, this is not why we're here. Governor made it clear that he would veto the bill anyway, and the legislature had other things to consider. So that's the reason that the bills didn't go any further than they did.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? Senator Bennett.
Mr. Chair, for the sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bennett.
Mr. Chair and Senator Glenn, I just got to ask you, I mean, what aspect of trans people being able to put their accurate gender on their birth certificate and live their lives fully and authentically, how does that negatively affect your life in any way at all?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bennett, that it doesn't. But what it does do is, if you will notice that the title of the bill is Vital Statistics, and statistics have to do with facts. And when your birth certificate is done, the facts are written on there: where you were born, the weight you were born, and the sex of the baby. And those are important items to document, and we use them all the time in statistics, in counting numbers and counting the number of people that were born in a certain area, looking at weights of babies, used for all kinds of things. And one of those things that we look at is, what are the sex of babies? And for those vital statistics, that's what it is. And it's based on those sex, on those facts that happen when the baby is born. As things change, I don't think that you should be able to go back and switch those facts of when things that happened at the time of birth. If you want to change things going forward, that's a different issue. But the facts of that are recorded on the birth certificate are just facts that are observed at birth time.
Further questions from the committee? I have one for Mr. Laszlofy. Mr. Laszlofy, I can appreciate the sponsor's desire for accurate data. Can you give us a societal compelling reason why society would want to see accuracy on birth certificates and what that means to us as just a human race in society?
Absolutely. So this is one of those issues that has been going on now in the United States for decades, and we're still working through it as a people. The issue of sex versus gender. One of the problems with this administrative rule is the fact that it changed sex to gender in that rule. Sex means one thing, gender means something entirely different. And this body has been wrestling with how to and whether to incorporate the term gender into the Montana Code in various ways. Sex is binary. There's no question about that. Your sex is determined by your DNA. Gender is a social construct. It is a continuum that can have an infinite number of genders on it. And so the question for us as a society is, where does that fit in to who we are as a society and how we move forward? This body's been wrestling with this issue for a long time, and our belief is that that issue should be left with this body. I realize that the other side believes that they're right, but they've got to realize that the way that things work in the United States, especially in this process, is that we come to consensus with disparate issues. We come to consensus through votes and decide how to move forward as a society. We're never all going to agree. But the only way to stay cohesive and move forward is, as a society, is to make a set of rules, set a process. We have that here in this body to vote, and then we've decided as Americans that we're going to move forward, and Montanans, we're going to move forward the way the vote goes. When an administrative rule like this is promulgated that touches on something that's not just a small issue, but that is a major policy change. It circumvents the process that I just described, and at that point, the system begins to break down. So that's the reason that we're involved in this issue.
Thank you. See, no other questions from the committee with the sponsor.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
Senator Weber has her hand raised.
Oh, I'm sorry. I can never see that hand on her screen. Senator Weber.
Mr. Chair, a question for S.K. Rossi, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber.
Mr. Chair, Rossi, I just have a question, and this is following up with what Mr. Laszlofy said. I'm confused about sex and gender, the definitions of sex and gender. To me, they're the same. Ask my sex. Okay, they're the same thing. According to the law, are there distinct definitions between the two?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Weber, thank you for that question. I think I'm going to re-refer that to Laurel Hess with the ACLU of Montana, if that's all right with you.
Thank you. Re-referred, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Chair, Senator Weber, thank you for the question, and apologies, I will be reading off of my phone, but thank you for the question. So the Montana Human Rights Bureau actually recently weighed in on this, and specifically when talking about sex discrimination and gender discrimination, which is applicable to this bill. And the Bureau has found that discrimination against people for being transgender is a type of illegal sex discrimination. In Maloney v. Yellowstone County in 2020, an administrative law judge with the Montana Department of Labor and Industry found that gender identity is, in fact, protected by the Montana Human Rights Act, and again, that is because gender discrimination is a form of sex discrimination. Thank you. Does that answer your question? I know it's...
It does. Follow-up, please, Mr. Chair. Okay. Will there be a burden on the courts to change, to change over to gender as opposed to sex? I mean, it seems like there would be some paperwork or the investigations. Do you see that happening?
Where I see where the burden to the court would be is that people would have to first get surgery and then go through a legal court proceeding process and get a court order, whereas right now they don't have to do that. So that, in my opinion, would be a new burden to the courts.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Could you enlighten me on the process of that? I know I've gone through a name change, which was basically when I got married, I just changed my name. It seems to me that listening to this testimony that there's more to it than just going to change your name as opposed to your sex or your gender.
Thank you for the question, Chair Senator Weber. I am not entirely familiar with what that court order process would entail. I do know that it would be an extra unnecessary and potentially dangerous step for people. It's one more time when a transgender, non-binary, or two-spirit person would have to go in front of another individual and discuss the private matters of who they are as a person. And I think that that's unnecessary and dangerous.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Are those court hearings public?
Would
it be public?
Thank you for the question. I would have to follow up with you on that, but I imagine yes. If someone else, can I defer that question? Does anybody know? May I defer to Sean Baker, please?
Defer.
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead. We refer that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Webb, can you repeat that question?
Mr. Chair, excuse me, I didn't get your name, sir.
Mr. Rager.
Mr. Rager, Are those hearings, or the process to get your gender changed or your sex changed, are they public?
So
are they for the public record?
Yeah. So along with a name change process, there are several steps that make that quite arduous. Individuals have to be able to obtain and fill out paperwork and then submit that to the court with an additional filing fee. Some individuals are able to obtain a sealed record, which prevents that from being public. However, it is difficult to obtain that sealed record. It's additional paperwork that has to be filed, and individuals have to know that that paperwork is available to be filed, and many people don't. In addition to that, when you're changing your name, if you do not have a sealed record, you have to publish it in a public newspaper or publication for, I believe, 6 weeks, and pay for the cost of that as well. So it's quite a lengthy and extensive process. And so to tie that to going to court for a gender marker change, individuals, I believe, might be able to request a sealed record, but it would be another additional step that people would have to know to access and would be difficult to obtain. In addition to that, the entire process puts a significant burden on the district court. The district courts, as we all know, are very overwhelmed right now, and the process would be even more drawn out, and it takes several months to be able to get through.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Manzella.
Thank you. Question for Mr. Rieger. Rieger? I'm not sure if I'm saying that right.
It's German, so it's Rieger.
Rieger, okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rieger, for being here. I find your testimony quite valuable. I'd like to ask you a couple questions concerning the sex reassignment process. If you find them too personal, just say so. I don't mean to be terribly intrusive, but I'm asking because I really don't know. How long does the process of sex reassignment actually take from start to finish?
So there is not a set timeline, and for everyone it happens individually. Some folks move through the process quite rapidly, and for others it takes years. The reality is that what a person needs to feel comfortable with who they are and to be seen for who they are in society varies greatly from person to person. Where one person may want to go through different processes and update gender markers on driver's licenses and other things, other people may not feel that that's necessary.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I'm specifically speaking of the surgical and the hormonal process.
Once again, it varies greatly. Okay. Depending on what the individual prefers.
All right.
Some people never go through a process of acquiring hormones or surgery. Some people do. And really, it's up to the individual for what they need to feel comfortable.
Thank you.
I will say, okay, thank you.
Just one more follow-up, please, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Mr. Rieger, thank you. You had made reference to the expense associated with this. Is there a... Can you offer any insight as to what the cost of sex reassignment surgery is?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Not. Would sponsor like to close?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Once again, this bill has two facets. One is, that we need to look at the discussion of whether we want to be able to change birth certificates the way it used to be with surgery and a judge, or do we want that to be done in a much more easily accessible and fluid process. And my opinion is that those birth records are a vital statistic tool, and they need to be based on facts. And that those facts need to be what happened when the baby was born. The other half of this bill is the rulemaking process in agencies and how it is not necessarily being followed, and the legislature has been circumvented in this regard. This is a major policy change. It shouldn't have went through rulemaking, and we're just standing up for our branch of government. The agency is an executive branch of government, and there should be separation. We give rulemaking to institute or to affect the laws that we have passed. The intent of those laws should be followed, and I don't think that this rulemaking did that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I encourage you to pass. Thank you.
Thank you. This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 280.
Members of the committee will now open the hearing on Senate Bill 277, McGillivray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I bring you today Senate Bill 277. And this Article 1, Section 1, United States Constitution. All legislative powers granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives. So this is a fundamental constitutional premise that all law is created by Congress, or it should be, according to our Constitution, which we all, as you know, take an oath to uphold when we swear in to this body, both the United States and the Montana Constitution. So Senate Bill 277 is a bill that seeks to allow the Attorney General of Montana, when he or she views an executive order or an administrative order coming from Washington as being unconstitutional, a way to push back. This is simply a tool. And the bill is pretty simple. And before I go into the bill, I would just like to say to you that, and I'm not going to pick on the current administration over any other administration specifically, but because there's been others that have historically been worse, but the jury's still out on what the current administration will issue for potential executive orders. But in January, based on which article you're reading, President, between 30 and 40 different executive orders. And in the first months of other presidents, the Trump administration issued 12. Obama, in his, the largest year was 16. Bush 2 was 7, Clinton 6, Bush 1 was 2, Reagan 5, Carter 7. FDR did 30. Actually, FDR holds the record for executive orders with 3,721. So he issued a lot of orders. Now, I think that there's some concern among not just Republicans but Democrats as well that this is getting out of hand, that we don't want to rule by executive order. We don't want executive issuing fiat orders which controls the country. We're not set up as that. We're a representative democracy, a republic, actually. And so what this bill does is it simply, as you read new Section 1, gives the Attorney General or the Governor an opportunity to look at executive orders as they come down in specific areas. And if those executive orders are deemed to be unconstitutional, then the Attorney General, Governor can say that any entity that receives public money, that could be a school, a hospital, any organization that takes public money would not be able to implement those executive orders. So this really is a process where the state of Montana can push back, that we can say enough, we are an independent sovereign, and we need to act like it, and this gives us a tool in the toolbox to act like it. Now, if you look at number two around line 21, the bill goes into where we can push back. So let me just read line 21. The state, a political subdivision, or an organization receiving public funds, that's tax dollars, from your constituents and mine, from the state, may not implement an executive order that the Attorney General determines to be unconstitutional under subsection 1 and that relates to number 1, 24, pandemics or other public health emergencies. So I think that we've all been through essentially almost 12 months now of seeing orders on pandemics. My concern is that what if an executive order comes down mandating that every school child must receive a vaccine before they can go to school? Or what if every foster family, we've had several bills on this recently from the good senator from the Bitterroot, is ordered to have a vaccine or they can't take a child? What are we going to do? This gives our Attorney General the ability to tell schools, no, we're not going to do that. What if the executive order comes down and says that you can't travel? You can't leave the state of Montana without a vaccine or a health certificate that says you have certain health vaccines or quarantines or, you know, you let your mind go wild here. I used to think that, you know, all these things were crazy conspiracy theories, but anymore I'm getting more and more concerned. But what if? Do we can say to the state of Montana public officials that, hey, you can travel if you want. We're not going to enforce that order. Or what about regulation, and this is line 25, regulation of our natural resources or their exploration or development, including but not limited to coal and oil. And I don't think that limits to coal and oil. Obviously, timber could be a part of that, forests. So there's what if a Green New Deal happens or an executive order happens that says that we can't log or we can't mine or we can't process coal. So the next one down is our agriculture industry. The waters of the U.S. during the Obama administration was a dangerous one, and it could affect any rancher or farmer that's has a wetlands on their property. So this is another concern. Then the regulation of the financial sectors, it relates to environmental, social, or governance standards. What if an executive order comes down that says public pension funds can't have coal stocks or energy stocks or something like that? So the last one is the constitutional rights, including but not limited to the right to bear arms. So I'm just wanting to bring this bill to give our Attorney General and Governor the ability to look at executive orders or administrative orders that are not constitutional and give them the ability to push back. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand down.
Thank you, Senator McGillivray. We'll now have proponents of Senate Bill 277. Any proponents in the room? Welcome. State your name and spell your last name, please.
My name is Cindy Hamilton, last name H-A-M-I-L-T-O-N.
And I, you know, rather than just give my opinion, I'd like to remind everybody of some things that are in our Constitution, because I think a lot of times, you know, we all think, oh, we know the Constitution, or we know the Bible, or whatever, but do we really? How? When's the last time we read it? Do we really know it? I grew up with the myth of universal federal supremacy, and then I learned later that was not true. The Supremacy Clause, so what I want to do is to actually go back to the source material. And you might think this is not speaking to the bill. It is, because this bill is sitting right in the middle of all this. So in the Supremacy Clause, Article 6 of the Constitution, Clause 2, this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. So what we have to really, really watch is that modifying phrase, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, because laws that are not made in pursuance of the delegated powers of the Constitution don't count. The 10th Amendment, Bill of Rights, says the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And that's just another way of reinforcing that if it's not in the Constitution, the federal government can't do it. It's if they make a law that's not one of their delegated powers, that law is invalid and of no consequence, no effect at all. Now, this is the interesting part to this bill, because we're talking about executive orders. And this is a very short part of the Constitution. The long part is what Congress can do. This is the part the president can do. And you're not going to see executive orders in here at all. Okay? Article 2, Section 2, tells what the president can do. The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the military of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. He may require the opinion in writing of the principal officer of each of the executive departments upon any subject relating to the duties of their respective offices. He shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. He shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided 2/3 of the senators present concur. And he shall nominate and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and councils, judges, the Supreme Court, and other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law. But the Congress may by law vest the appointment of other such inferior officers as they think proper in the president alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments. Okay, and one more. The president shall have the power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session. In Article 3, it just says, he shall from time to time give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. You haven't seen anything about executive orders yet. He may, on extraordinary occasions, convene both houses or either of them and in case of disagreement between them with respect to the time of adjournment, he may adjourn them to such time as he think proper. He shall receive ambassadors and other public ministers. He shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed and shall commission to the officers, all the officers of the United States. Now, there's one other delegated power of the president, which is delegated in another part of the Constitution, and that is the veto power. He's also given the veto power over laws of the legislature.
So, Ms. Hamilton, I've given you a little bit of latitude, but you need to wrap it up in about 2.5 minutes.
I believe that's about it. I think that's about it. I wanted to use my time to go to the original source so that all of you, and looking around, I think that a lot of you, at least who are in the room, do read the Constitution. But sometimes it's nice to remind people of the actual wording and the fact that executive orders have no basis in our Constitution. It's not a delegated power of the president. And so I think this law, this is the bill I am most excited about of everything that I've seen so far this session. This is the biggie. This is the biggie. This is the one that's going to allow us to push back against what's happening in Washington and protect Montana from the craziness that's happening in Washington.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For the proponents in the room, any proponents online? Seeing none. Any opponents in the room? Seeing none. Any opponents online?
That was the longest one.
Ms. Lynch.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Lynch, LYNCH. I'm Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Montana League of Cities and Towns. We represent all 127 incorporated municipalities in Montana. I wouldn't be here today on this bill, except that it does tell our members what they can and can't do. And as you know, we always stand in opposition to local preemption. But I've got to be honest, from an attorney's perspective, I don't understand what this bill does or even really what it's trying to do. The bill would have the Attorney General, either at the request of legislative counsel or the AG's own initiative, determine the constitutionality of a presidential executive order. But then it goes on to say that the AG may seek to have the order declared unconstitutional. So who will the AG seek to make this determination? And why would he need to seek to have it declared unconstitutional if it says he has the ability to declare it unconstitutional? There's some questions about which constitution are we talking about, issues of federalism and separation of powers. I appreciate that the sponsor is trying to get at this issue, but I think this bill only further confuses these legal constructs. The president does not have any power to force state and local governments to take any action or follow any policy. That was made clear in the Prince case that actually originated in Montana. The president can't order us to vaccinate Montanans, to not travel, to wear masks, as the Prince case held. That power rests only with the state. I want to point out that I'm not sure the AG even has authority to answer questions regarding the constitutionality of a law. He doesn't answer requests for opinions on the constitutionality of statutes or interpretation of any federal laws. It's really an issue of separation of powers, both at the federal and the state constitutional levels. There's already a process to push back against the kinds of presidential orders that the sponsor is talking about. If the Attorney General or this body or any local government believes that a presidential order is unconstitutional, the method to stop its application is to file a lawsuit to declare it so. That's exactly what Prince did. It involved the sheriff of Ravalli County. He brought that lawsuit about having to run background checks, and he won that in the United States Supreme Court. I'm worried that it goes on to compound these problems by purporting to restrict all governmental entities in Montana from implementing such an order, because I can't, first of all, think of any executive order that's ever required some action on the part of local governments. It doesn't explain what will happen if an entity somehow found to be implementing such an order. It doesn't say who will make the investigation, make that determination, doesn't say what a penalty is or if there even is one. And it doesn't give us any notice of what action we are expected to take or not take, other than just to not implement an order, the contents of which at this time are completely unknown. I would suggest that this bill be a resolution being expressed by this body. It's based entirely on what-if scenarios. And the bottom line is that the president cannot issue executive orders commandeering the power of state or local governments. We respectfully ask that you table SB 277. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lynch. Further opponents, any online? Seeing none. Any informational witnesses in the room? Any online? Seeing none. Questions from the committee? Senator Manziel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Manziel.
Mr. Chair, Senator McGilvery, thank you for bringing this bill. I think it will be very helpful in our efforts to push back against the federal government. But I would like to better understand, do you think that having the Attorney General issue an opinion about the President's executive orders concerning the COVID pandemic and then the results on local governments concerning our election, do you think that that might have affected his opinion may have had some effect on the outcome of that election?
Of which election?
Our presidential election. Based on the fact that the mail-in ballots actually came based on the COVID pandemic executive order?
I don't know. I guess I would just follow up that question by just saying that the opponent spoke about a lot of ambiguity, or she doesn't know how this is going to all play out. I frankly don't know either. But again, this is a tool. And the AG looked at this tool. They're not in here today, but they did look at it. And they brought no opposition, obviously. So I think that they can use the tool as they see fit.
Further questions from the committee? Senator Bennett.
Mr. Chair, a question for the sponsor.
Senator McGilvery.
Senator Bennett.
Mr. Chair and Senator McGilvery, I am just kind of generally interested in how you see this clashing with the Supremacy Clause.
Do I see this clashing with the Supremacy Clause?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Supremacy Clause essentially says that, you know, they get to tell us, you know, what to do at the higher level as we are able to tell people below us. It seems like there's some conflict here. Can you speak to how you see those two things working together?
Well, I do think that the Supremacy Clause has been taken too far, that the states do have some sovereignty. Obviously, the 10th Amendment that was the proponent brought up. And I just think, again, that this pushes back against the chief executive of the United States, the president, from potentially interfering in our affairs. And I have some deep concern that that's where the nation is heading. It's getting more and more prevalent. And, I believe in the 10th Amendment. I do think, obviously, I brought another bill this committee looked at that provided a mechanism to push back, and I just think this is another tool that the federal government is not allowed in the state of Montana to push us all around.
Mr. Chair, can I have a follow-up?
Go ahead, Senator Bennett.
Mr. Chair and Senator McGilvery, can you speak to the concern from Ms. Lynch about the language in here about the AG seeking to have something declared unconstitutional? Is the vision that they would bring something to the courts, to the Supreme Court, or is your vision that they just kind of have that power by themselves and by the fact that they're the AG, they get to say this is constitutional or this is not?
I think the AG can weigh in on the constitutionality of an executive order. I think that's within his purview.
Okay. or Mr. Chair, just really quickly, just for clarification, that's what the intent of the bill is that you want the AG to have that power?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Further question, Senator Friedel? No. Senator Heimbaugh.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask a question of the sponsor. I'd just like to use a couple of phrases before I ask the question. One of them is the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and the other one is if you don't ask, you won't get it. And I think that's one thing we have not done enough of in this country is ask for things. I just would like to have you comment a little bit on the the private property takings that already has happened by the government, one of the president's executive orders concerning the Keystone Pipeline. It had thousands of jobs and millions of dollars invested and billions of dollars that had already been spent here and lots of tax money around here. Does that seem like it would be something that would be kind of a something to address on this whole deal?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Heimbaugh, I think that I would like it to, but I don't know that this bill goes there, because even though that I believe the executive order would shut down the Keystone Pipeline is a violation of the 4th and 14th Amendments due process, it was a taking a company that had invested billions of dollars, private companies that had invested in inventory and probably tens of millions of dollars, was just a pure taking. This bill, I don't think, goes there because it doesn't affect, there's no local entity I can see that the Keystone is affecting that this bill would impact, I don't think. But I could be wrong.
Further questions from the committees? Senator Weber.
Mr. Chair, for the sponsor, please.
Senator McGilvray.
Senator Weber, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, Senator, on line 21, it says a state, a political division, or an organization receiving public funds from the state may not implement an executive order that the Attorney General deemed unconstitutional. Can you give me an example of that?
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Weber, for the question. I did give an example in my opening. Let's say the executive orders is that all children will have to have shots to go to public school. I think that's a perfect example. And before we say that's far-fetched, a year ago, or in 2019 when we were in this session, we would never have dreamed of the things that happened. And there were actually bills to push back on some of the local things that happened, and people thought, oh, those are not necessary. And I think that we need to have some vision here that, Senator Weber, that this is preemptive.
Follow-up?
Follow-up, Senator.
So if they decided to comply with an executive order saying vaccines or vaccinate your children to go to school, would state money be withheld from them against the Attorney General's determination? It's unconstitutional.
Bill, Senator Weber, Mr. Chairman, the bill doesn't say that. It just says that the schools could not say to a parent that you must vaccinate your child to come to school. That's how I would interpret the bill.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
If a parent wants to do that, that's totally fine.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Manziel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the sponsor. I love talking about the Constitution. So just to confirm that we're on the same page concerning the Supremacy Clause, I'd like your opinion. The federal government is... their powers are enumerated under Article 1, Section 8. And as far as the Supremacy Clause is concerned, laws that Congress makes must be made in pursuance thereof the enumerated powers. Is that the way you see it?
Yes, Senator Manziel. And that's how I opened the bill, too, that Congress makes the laws.
Thank you. Just wanted to confirm that we were on the same page with that. Yep.
Further questions? If not, the senator may close on his bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I close.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll hand the gavel back to you.
Well, that ends the hearing on Senate Bill 277. Committee, we got done a lot faster than I anticipated, so we should have plenty of time for executive action. Those of you on Zoom land, did you get the list of executive action bills? Okay. And let's add in the bills then that we heard today. Ms. Burkhart, if a bill that we heard today, if somebody wants to amend it, can that be done by the beginning of by Saturday?
Mr. Chairman, I believe so.
Okay. All right. Tell you what, let's take a break and come back. We'll give you a long one. Let's go till 10:10. 10 minutes after 10, we'll come back then and do executive action. 10 minutes after 10, and we'll try to include the bills that we heard today. We are in recess. Committee, let's be in order. We'll go into executive action, and we'll start with Senate Bill 256.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move to pass on Senate Bill 256.
Committee, this was a bill by Senator Flowers, providing that the owner of a locked gate on a public road that prevents access to public land may be prosecuted for harassment. No amendments that I'm aware of, correct, Ms. Burkhart?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Questions, comments on Senate Bill 256? Senator Manzella.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I regretfully am going to have to be a no on this bill. I think I have the premier case of this situation in Ravalli County, and it is a much bigger issue than we might realize as far as the adjudication associated with determining if a road is private or public. And in my case, this road has been gated off for years and years and years based on the fact that there's mining land patents involved. And of course, those are some of the original property rights. And now the gate has been removed, and not only is their private property being assaulted, but their land patents are as well. And this is a situation where it just continues to be appealed, and up the chain it goes. So I would hate for property owners to have to endure these fines while they were in the process of adjudicating their claim. Mr. Chair.
Anyone else?
Question?
Question's been called for. We'll do a roll call vote. Senate Bill 256.
Vice Chair McGilvery?
No.
Vice Chair Sands?
Yes.
Senator Esp?
No.
Senator Heinbaugh?
No.
Senator Bennett?
Yes.
Senator Manzella?
No.
Senator Weber?
Yes.
Senator Brown?
No.
Senator Fridell?
No.
Senator Gross?
Senator Bennett?
Oh, excuse me. Yes, by proxy.
Okay.
Chairman Regeer?
No.
4 members have voted aye. 7 members have voted no.
Mr. Chair, I would move to reverse that vote and table.
Okay.
Bill 256.
Okay. Motion is to table Senate Bill 256. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
Nay.
Senator Gross votes nay by proxy.
Okay. You have a question, Ms. Sterling? Okay. Next, Senate Bill 259.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 259 to pass.
Sorry to let Manzella do that. This was by Senator Manzella. Senator Manzella, you want to talk about your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. This is the bill that prevents a governmental entity from interfering with parental rights and offers them the clause escapes me at the moment. Anyway, it's to protect parental rights and create an opportunity for them to seek a judicial process when their parental rights has been denied by or assaulted by a governmental entity, and it would be at their expense, so there's no fiscal note associated with it, Mr. Chair.
And Ms. Burkhart, no amendments to 259, correct?
No amendments to 259, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? comments? Senator Esp.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I think there are some problems in this bill. One of the witnesses brought up on line three that the parent gets attorney's fees if he or she wins, but there's not reciprocity for the agency or whoever, the governmental entity. You know, I don't often talk about this publicly, but I had a child in my life that was had a parent who, unlike the proponents of this bill, it says their parents' internal compass would look after their children. This particular mom's compass didn't work. And I don't think we can make the presumption that the parent is always looking out after the best interests of their child. And so I think for that reason and also the reason that Lance Melton brought up, the School Boards Association brought up, I'm going to be a no on this bill, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else?
I have a question for the sponsor.
Senator,
go ahead. I just, Senator Manzella, the section down on 26 of the first line, our first page, rather, this section may not be constructed as invalidating the provisions of Title 41. So if I'm familiar with Title 41, this basically says that the state still has all the tools at their disposal in the event that what Senator Esp just said was the issue. Am I correct?
That's correct. That is my understanding as well.
All right. Thank you. I just have to say I'm going to support the bill, and with all due respect, Senator Esp, whom I respect highly, I think this is such a fundamental right. It is so inherent that I just cannot see why I wouldn't vote yes on it. And so I think that the state has to have an extremely compelling interest to override this. And I think this gives the parent a little bit of a tool to push back against an over-aggressive state. So, thank you.
Senator Sands.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I concur with Senator Esp's assessment. I mean, parents do have so many rights, and of course, they're the ones who primarily should raise their kids. But parents can go astray, and I think that's why in human society over time, we've tried to create places where the community can, in this case, in the version of the government, can come in and make sure that that child is protected in some way. And so this bill, I think, is just so overly broad and doesn't even recognize an emancipation by a youth as being a legitimate concern. It is just so broad, and I think Attorney Gail Goheen really went through all of the areas in this that are probably unconstitutional. And so I think if someone wants to bring something more narrow, there might be, there's certainly legitimate issues always to raise here, but this bill is so broad and would so put children at risk from in the areas of education, particularly their safety, whether it's relative to suicide or other mental health issues or so many areas. Anyway, for that reason, I'm going to be voting no, because I think it is a huge overreach to say parents are the only ones who have a responsibility for a child. Thank you.
Senator Weber.
Mr. Chair, I have, Ms. Goheen, she brought up a lot of questions, a lot of holes in this bill, and some of the things that she said, there is a potential problems was in a mental health care determined by the courts. How is this going to affect parental plan plans by the courts. And this state cannot mandate the education of a child. That was a big one for me. So that the state cannot, it'll be the parent that does that. It just seems like that would be an overburden to our educational system as is. The judicial system with children and the juvenile system, what's going to happen there? And then just the fiscal responsibility of this whole, implementing this whole bill. So I... There was just too many questions for me that weren't answered in this bill, and the implementation of it would be, I think, a real big challenge. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, we'll do a roll call vote on Senate Bill 259.
Vice Chair McGilvery?
Yes.
Vice Chair Sands?
No.
Senator Esp?
No.
Senator Heinbach?
Yes.
Senator Bennett?
No.
Senator Manzella? Senator Manzella?
Yes.
Senator Weber?
No.
Senator Brown?
Yes.
Senator Friedel?
Yes.
Senator Gross?
No by proxy.
Chairman Regeer?
Yes.
6 members have voted aye, 5 members have voted no.
Okay, Senate Bill 259 is passed out of committee. Next, we'll go to Senate Bill 283.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move to pass on Senate Bill 283.
Committee, this was by Senator Glimm and dealt with laws regarding firearms on school grounds. And Ms. Burkhart, there is an amendment, correct?
Mr. Chairman, let me do a little checking because I wasn't aware of one. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are no amendments to this bill that I, at least, that are on the system or that I was requested to draft.
Where did I get this amendment from?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if that was a question for me, but...
Well, yeah, I guess it is. SB 283.1, and was things that the senator was talking about yesterday. I think Mr. Melton had some concerns, and I've got where it struck out of the title. Okay, tell you what. Let's put that back. We'll work on it, and...
Yeah.
See where the amendment is. Do you withdraw the motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw my due pass motion on Senate Bill 283.
Okay. Committee, let's take a look at the bills we heard today and see whether we can get through executive action on them. We'll start with Senate Bill 318.
Mr. Chair, I'll move due pass on Senate Bill 318.
Okay. Senator Manzella, you want to... talk about it?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is should be a very simple bill, and I understand that people are confused, but basically what it says is that a person who is an attorney and a judge both, they serve a dual purpose, they can't practice law in their own court. And I don't think I can make it any more simple than that.
Ms. Burkhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to answer Senator McGilvery's question from during the discussion on this bill. municipal courts are for cities with a population over 4,000, and that can be found in MCA 3-6-101. And right now there's 6, the bigger cities in Montana, excuse me. Missoula, Billings, Bozeman, Great Falls, Helena, and possibly Kalispell. The rest of the towns in Montana the rest of the incorporated municipalities have city courts. And city courts are often run by the county justice of the peace, particularly in the smaller communities, under an MOU between the county and the city. So because JPs don't have to be attorneys, then, you know, this, it doesn't impact as many city court judges by, you know, by its very nature. But obviously there was at least one that who contacted the Attorney General's office. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Anyone else? Senator Bennett.
Mr. Chair, a question for Ms. Burkhart. Can you help clarify for me the difference between a municipal court and a city court? I would think that would be the same thing, but I see that we're adding new language in here.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Bennett. That's basically what I just explained. I mean, they basically, they stand, they do the same thing. So whether you're in front of a municipal court in Helena, Montana, or you're in front of a city court in a small town somewhere in Montana, the courts are going, they're going to make decisions on whatever is in their jurisdiction, which tends to be, you know, things, misdemeanors and things like that, that are not, that go there first before they go to the district court, if they ever go to the district court. And so, but for, but municipalities with populations over 4,000 can have municipal courts. And if the city is smaller than 4,000, then it's a city court. But basically, they do the same things.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Burkhart, so I guess my follow-up here is kind of wondering how this situation may arise. So this would be a situation maybe where a judge is serving as a lawyer in front of a temporary judge who might be there, or how is it that a judge would be practicing in their own court?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bennett, members of the committee, so I think what would probably happen, and it would not happen much, because most city court judges in the smaller communities are not attorneys. However, if it does happen, it would be a situation where the city court judge is the actual assigned, appointed, elected judge for that jurisdiction. It wouldn't be a temporary judge. And so if you had a city court where the judge happened to be an attorney, then that judge would not be allowed under this bill to practice in that court.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Question.
Okay, question's been called. We'll do a roll call vote on Senate Bill 318.
Vice Chair McGilvery?
Yes.
Vice Chair Sands?
Yes.
Senator Esp?
Yes.
Senator Hindbaugh?
Yes.
Senator Bennett?
Yes.
Senator Manzella?
Yes.
Senator Weber?
Yes.
Senator Brown?
Yes.
Senator Fidel?
Yes.
Senator Gross?
Yes, by proxy.
Chairman Regeer?
Yes.
11 members have voted aye.
Next, we'll take a look at Senate Bill 271. Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'll move to pass on Senate Bill 271.
This was a bill by Senator Glimm, an act allowing judicial candidates to announce an endorsement. Questions, comments on the bill? Senator Sands.
Mr. Chair, I mean, this concerns me. I think our government has been founded on separation of powers. And the public in general wants to believe that its courts are not as political, maybe not they're apolitical, but they're not as political as those of us who run for partisan office. And I think that's important, that regardless of where you live, you should feel like you can walk into a court and be treated on the merits of the case and not ever have to be concerned that you believe that the judge ran on a partisan basis and therefore you might be treated differently in that court. And I think that's such a fundamental issue and concern of the public. And for that reason, I think this is not a good idea and not a good bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bennett.
Mr. Chair, I do just want to step in as well to echo some of the concerns from Senator Sands. I think that folks in Montana expect that those of us up here at the legislature are going to have political leanings. We are there to, you know, advance different issues that we care about, often different from each other, and that makes a lot of sense. But I mean, when you go into a courtroom, you don't want to be standing in front of a Democratic judge or a Republican judge or Green Party judge or a judge that has the backing of this organization or that organization. You want to be in front of a judge that's going to be impartial and not, you know, tied to one political philosophy or another, but somebody who's solely tied to the Constitution and the state laws of Montana. And I think that by allowing judges to go around openly being partisan, it's going to hurt the integrity of the judicial system. People will have less faith in the outcomes and more thoughts that, well, the judge just ruled against me because of my political philosophy or because I was aligned with this group and not that group. And I think that that's going to hurt us in the long run. I mean, I think we desperately need an independent judiciary that's going to make sure that everyone is equal under law, no matter who you support in an election.
I guess my response to that would be, yeah, I would hope that the judges would rule according to the law and not their desires. But, I mean, for them to conceal their prejudices and it only comes out in their rulings, I think that's doing a disservice to the public. As I read this bill, it says they may announce. They don't have to announce the endorsement. So they're leaving that up to the judge candidate. So I don't see where this is a bad bill. I see it as a good one. Any other comments? Senator Brown.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I know that in this last election cycle that we had, I received, I don't know, probably 30 calls from people asking me. They're looking for more information. They're wanting to know what... you know, how a judge aligns with my philosophy, you know, and I always don't have all that information either. It's hard for me to do that, but I know the people are actually desire to be getting more information about judges, and I believe this is a good way for some of that to happen. And so, you know, and you start talking about, okay, that gives me some, you know, some of these smaller areas, that gives me quite a bit of influence in that election. That maybe I shouldn't have. The people should be making the choice themselves and through good information. So, you know, I'm going to be a yes, and I just believe we need more transparency in who our judges are. Okay.
Senator Weber.
Mr. Chair, I just see that this could open the door for judge shopping. For those judges that are aligned with your philosophy, or my philosophy. And also, it seems to me that wouldn't the American Bar Association have something to say about their behavior? We're just making this assumption that, you know, they'll rule in favor of what we want them to if this bill passes.
Anyone else? Senator Heimbaugh?
I was just going to say, let's call a question. We've heard all the discussion on this thing.
Question's been called for. Time to vote. We'll do a roll call vote on Senate Bill 271.
Vice Chair McGilvery?
Yes.
Vice Chair Sands?
No.
Senator Esp?
Yes.
Senator Heinbaugh?
Yes.
Senator Bennett?
No.
Senator Manzella?
Yes.
Senator Weber?
No.
There you got it.
Senator Brown?
Yes.
Senator Friedel?
Yes.
Senator Gross?
No by proxy.
Chairman Regeer?
Yes.
7 members have voted aye. 4 members have voted no.
Senate Bill 271 has passed out of committee. Next, we'll look at Senate Bill 280.
Mr. Chair, I'll move to pass on Senate Bill 280.
This was a bill by Senator Glimm revising vital statistic laws regarding amending of birth certificate sex designation. Questions, comments on Senate Bill 280? Senator Bennett.
Mr. Chair, members of the body, I'm just going to be fully honest and say this is a pretty gross attack on transgender people. And that's exactly what it is. I mean, I'm not going to let this committee for a half second pretend that this is a statistics bill, because it's not. If it were, we'd have people from the Bureau of Statistics in here saying, we desperately need this information. They weren't, because it's not important. The reason this bill is here is because people don't want transgender folks to have these rights. This is about stealing away those rights from people. And I want to be fully, fully clear that the ability for transgender people in Montana to be able to change the gender on their birth certificate will have no negative effect on anyone in this room and anyone in Montana. I can guarantee you that. There is nothing in any way that is going to harm any Montanan by allowing transgender people to change a birth certificate and live their authentic life. But it is a big deal for trans people. It is a big deal because it gives them one of the tools that allows them, if they so choose, to change their name, to be able to get a new driver's license, to update their social security information, to be able to just live their authentic life in a way that incredibly helps them transition the way that is meaningful to them. This is a deeply, deeply harmful bill for no reason except for the reason that the sponsor wants to do it, which is a pretty awful reason to push a discriminatory agenda.
Senator McGilvery.
Mr. Chair, this is a sensitive bill for a lot of people, and I respect that, and I just want to say my comments with all due respect, because I believe that we should respect all people. But I do see some problems here if we go down this path, and I would just point out one here with women's sports. It seems wrong to me that if I changed my sex on a birth certificate, that that would allow me to then get into a women's athletic women's athletic events, even though I'm a male by birth, because that's not fair to women. I think that's unfair to them to have individuals born as men involved in their athletic events, because they simply have bigger stature, they have more physical strength, and I don't have to go into that in detail because I think everybody gets it. But that's one of the things I see as a practical outgrowth of this. And I know that there are states like New York where individuals are beginning to be arrested because they used the wrong pronoun. And I just think that I'm going to be a yes on this bill.
Senator Sands.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be a no on this bill. I think this bill is one of the most disrespectful, harmful bills in this session. And for me, it is also deeply personal. The trans community is my community. And actually, it's all your community, too. And probably most of you really don't know what the life of a trans person is like. I have a relative who is a trans person and known that from the time they were a small child. It is a long process. It has many decisions along the way, made with family, made with a physician. And this bill decides, well, there is only one way you can be a trans person, and that is have surgery, number one. So it's throwing up nothing but it's practicing medicine, and you don't really know anything about that person's life or their needs or their desires. And it is interfering in every way, making it more difficult for a trans person simply to be who they are. It does no harm to anyone else in the state. And that whole issue around sports, with all due respect, is one that has been settled at the national level over and over by the entities that govern sports and have certainly made space for trans people in there. It is not an issue for them. I don't know why it's an issue for you. Let's respect people's right to be who they are. This bill goes in exactly the opposite direction. There's no freedom in this bill for a trans person to make their own decisions. There's no personal responsibility to let a a trans person make personal decisions about what they need. This bill is cruel and it's mean, and I'm voting no.
Senator Weber.
Mr. Chair, let's see. No, I have to agree with Senator Sands and Senator Bennett about this being totally, totally wrong, this bill. Now, I can identify with the transgender community. In the area of discrimination, as an Indian, I live with discrimination all the time. Every time I come off the reservation, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. I look like I do, you know, and I know what they're going through. I know what they're feeling because I have to live with it every day. And so with that, you know, any type of these discrimination bills like this, it hurts me. It hurts me because I know what they're going through. And I know what this 7% of the population of Montana is going through every day. So I just have to be a no, and I align with our people here. They're creative, they're intelligent, they're beautiful people, and that's what I believe.
Senator Manzella.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No doubt this is a very sensitive issue. I heard some of the House hearing, and there was some interesting testimony that was offered that many people, while going through the process of growing up and puberty and just coming into adulthood, go through periods in their life where they change their mind as to how they want to live their life. And a lot of them, by the time they reach adulthood, change their mind again. And so I think it is extremely important that we do keep vital statistics accurate for the purposes of, you know, criminal behavior. When you're looking, you know, if someone's committed a crime, you need to know if you're looking for a man or a woman. And this bill requires the person to have gone through the process of making a commitment to their new sex. And so for that reason, I appreciate the bill. And I also want to appreciate the policy aspect of this, that I do believe that the department did overstep in their process and that it is a legislative decision. And for those reasons, I will be supporting the bill.
Question?
Well, I'd like to add on to, if the department would have come to the legislature instead of just doing it in rule, we could have had this discussion, would have been better. Questions been called for. We'll do a roll call vote. Senate Bill 280.
Vice Chair McGilvery?
Yes.
Vice Chair Sands?
No.
Senator Esp?
Yes.
Senator Heinbaugh?
Yes.
Senator Bennett?
No.
Senator Manzella?
Yes.
Senator Weber?
No.
Senator Brown?
Yes.
Senator Friedel?
Yes.
Senator Gross?
No by proxy.
Chairman Regeer?
Yes.
7 members have voted aye, 4 members have voted no.
Senate Bill 280 has passed out of committee. Next, we'll look at Senate Bill 277.
Chair, I move to pass on Senate Bill 277.
This was a bill Senator McGilvery had. You want to fill us in?
Yeah, this is a simple bill, basically related to states' rights, requiring a review of presidential executive orders by the Attorney General. And if the Attorney General finds an executive order unconstitutional, then the state, any state or political subdivision or organization receiving public funds from the state may not implement the executive order. And I think this is just preemptive. We're seeing presidents more and more and more use executive orders. I don't think that's healthy for anybody. I think it undermines the Constitution that Congress is supposed to make laws. And as orders are proliferated in exponential numbers as we go on in history, I think this is, again, preemptive and gives, the state of Montana another tool to push back.
Anyone else? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll tell you what was completely going through my mind as we were going through this. And you know, we were thinking about sovereign governments, and which brought to mind we have, you know, our sovereign tribal nations in the state. You know, I believe they do a great job of pushing back when the state maybe is encroaching on their rights. I think I think that's something that the state could maybe learn from those sovereign nations, as we say, because we don't. We don't push back often enough, and we should be standing up for our sovereign rights even more. And I believe there is something that we could learn from those tribal governments.
Senator Weber.
To follow Senator Brown's comment, I have to say that if this affects the tribes, because we're not a political entity of the state, and we have a treaty, we have treaties, which I'm not sure about the law, if they preempt the Constitution or the same as the Constitution, but we do have treaties that why we push back at the state, because those are between the United States and the tribal nations. So it was kind of a strange little thing for me to sit there and hear this, because how is it going to affect the tribes? I don't know.
Senator Sands.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have problems with this bill as well, partly because I think we continue to pass bills that are dealing with past incidences and grievances versus passing legislation that is necessary for us to move forward. This bill in particular gives all the authority in the end to the Attorney General to determine constitutionality of a federal executive order. I think there are issues around federal supremacy here, but what about the role of the governor? Not mentioned in here. Does the governor have anything to say about whether this is an executive order that he or she supports? And what about other things that flow from an executive order in cases of 2A, pandemics or other health emergencies? When it was declared a federal emergency, all kinds of money started to flow from the federal government to support our local businesses. This bill would say that the public funds could not basically be used or flow until this process went through a court process to determine whether, in fact, that executive order was constitutional or not. Businesses in Montana during this pandemic, more of them would have failed if it were not for the support that has come from the federal level in this emergency to help them. What about funding from the federal level to provide support and help for our public health in this emergency, funding for PPEs and other things that have been needed? If the Attorney General decided in his or her opinion that this was not constitutional, the delay of that would cost people their lives. This bill is giving all that authority basically to one entity, an Attorney General, to override whatever the concerns might be by the governor, even by the full legislature, and by the federal government in situations of emergencies, as well as other regulatory areas. I think this bill is dangerous going forward, and I totally oppose it, Mr. Chair.
Senator Esp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not to belabor the bill, but if you look on lines 18, 19, and 20, as I read the bill, the process is legislative council request a review by the governor and the attorney general, and then the state, I'm assuming through the executive branch and possibly the attorney general, so seek an exemption from the application of the order or seek to have the order declared unconstitutional. which I assume means file suit in federal court to address the constitutionality of the order. Now, perhaps lines 21 and 22 could have said that they may not implement the executive order that has been exempted for the state or is under litigation by the Attorney General, but I think the intent of the bill is to have a court process before this is it. And I guess the sponsor can speak for himself, but I think that was his intent.
Senator Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to echo some of the concerns, and let me first off say that I think that there is a lot of really good intention in here, and certainly federal overreach is something that we should address, but as much as we're concerned about consolidating the powers within the presidency, I do feel like, and the questions I was asking the sponsor were intentional, because I feel like we are consolidating a lot of power with the Attorney General. I mean, they can either by themselves or by a recommendation of the legislature decide if something is constitutional, and by their determination alone, money stops flowing, you know, other people can't enforce these things, and because of that, the legislature doesn't get a say. No, we actually think it's okay. The governor doesn't get a say. I mean, no one else in this process. We're putting a tremendous amount of power in the hands of one elected official, and if there were some more checks and balances here, I think that we might have a way to move this forward, but I don't think that one elected officer unto themselves should be able to completely upend the ability for the state, political subdivisions, or organizations to enforce a law, and beyond that, stop receiving some of the funding that is tied to some of these things.
Senator Sands. Oh, anyone else? Okay. We'll do a roll call vote. Senate Bill 277.
Vice Chair McGilvery?
Yes.
Vice Chair Sands?
No.
Senator Esp?
Yes.
Senator Heinbaugh?
Yes.
Senator Bennett?
No.
Senator Manzella?
Yes.
Senator Weber?
No.
Senator Brown?
Yes.
Senator Friedel?
Yes.
Senator Gross?
No by proxy.
Chairman Regeer?
Yes.
7 members have voted aye. 4 members have voted no.
Okay, committee. Ms. Burkhart, I think Senator Glimm will be contacting you about an amendment to 283. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, committee, we got Friday and Saturday coming up here. When I schedule these bills, I look at the title, try to look at the bills, and try to anticipate how long a hearing's going to be. I thought today we'd be here till at least noon, but it went short. So you can second-guess me all you want. That's okay. Tomorrow we will hear 4 bills, and Senator Sands, yours was just added, SB 373. Okay.
Yes, so thank you for doing that.
You bet. Mm-hmm. That'll be tomorrow. One of them is an assisted suicide bill, so I kind of anticipate that might take a while. So we'll hear 4 bills tomorrow starting at 8 o'clock, and then Saturday we have 6 bills that we will hear. 6. I was told floor session will start Saturday at 8. I don't know how long it will go. We might have more than one board take a recess and come back. But once the floor session is over, we'll come back to these chambers and hear right now 6 bills, unless there's another one lurking out there that they'll throw at us too. So is that clear? Ms. Burkhart?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a quick question. If the Senate has multiple boards on Saturday and the breaks are fairly long, do you anticipate coming in here and getting a couple bills done in any
question.
If it's like an hour-long break?
Yes. Yes, we'll okay. Do that. Yeah. And looking at the titles of those 6 bills, they shouldn't be long ones. But that's the famous last words, isn't it?
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Sands, go ahead.
My assumption would also be, based on what we're doing now, is we'll take executive action on the bills as, like, all the ones on Friday.
That would be my intent, yes.
Thank you.
We just have Senate Bill 283 out there, and tomorrow then all four of those bills will, if we have time, take a little bit of a break and then go into executive action.
Okay? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else have anything for the good of the committee? Okay, we are adjourned.